First of all, let me just make the statement very clear. I believe we need to legalize marijuana.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was Senator Kamala Harris, the California Democrat running for president, talking about the need for marijuana legalization, which has become a mainstream position that many 2020 candidates support. Meanwhile, CBD, cannabidiol, has become a new battlefront for researchers and politicians. And in our first segment, my colleagues Sarah Overmall and Paul Demko talk about the science and politics around CBD and marijuana. Then I'll catch up with my colleagues Rachna Pradhan and Adam Kankren to discuss other healthcare issues like abortion and drug pricing that are playing a role in the campaign. Let's get to those conversations. I'm joined now by Sarah Overmall, one of our pharma reporters. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hey.
And Paul Demko, one of our health reporters who specializes in marijuana news, too.
Thanks for having me.
You two are our de facto pot team at Politico. Don't know if we need to drug test before this podcast. My personal opinion on some of what we're going to discuss is a little skeptical. Maybe that will come across. But why don't we start here? On Friday, the FDA is convening a hearing, landmark hearing, on CBD, cannabis. Sarah, you will be at this hearing. Why is it so important?
Well, first of all, CBD is cannabidiol. It's a part of the cannabis plant, and it's the part that Congress legalized along with hemp in December with the Farm Bill. And since then, Congress has been pretty frustrated with the FDA for kind of throwing this substance into uncertainty by pointing out that they have approved a drug that has this product in it. And so this is kind of seen as the first step that FDA is going to take to clarify when this can be used, how it can be used, how it will be regulated, whether these medical claims have to be checked, and the potency of different products.
You're talking about regulating a drug that, frankly, I get ads for every single day. I count it. I've gotten 10 different emails in the past week promising CBD cures for various ailments. So this is already on the market.
Oh, yeah. Cures, skincare. It's in lattes for like $8 if you want to spend that amount on it. It's already on the market, and different states have taken different approaches in the absence of federal clarity. So the problem was, much like with actual cannabis, with the broader marijuana plant, states were already legalizing this to some certain extent, but now the FDA has pointed out that they could take a harsher route if they wanted to. It's largely thought that they won't. They're just trying to make sure that everybody on the market is smart about this, that they don't make really dumb medical claims, and that, you know, there's also this protection for CBD pharmaceuticals that have been approved. So there's one that has already been approved called Epidiolex for two different types of epilepsy, but there's a few others in the pipeline already. And so if you just allow all of these products to run wild and say, you know, this can help you with your Alzheimer's, with your anxiety, with your PTSD, then that means drug makers aren't actually going to develop these products and study these claims. Or at least that's the argument that former Commissioner Gottlieb and the FDA have made.
Isn't there also an issue of products making claims, not just of medical, medical claims, but also about the content of the product that hasn't held up to some testing, like the level of CBD in these products? I've seen some tests that show, you know, doesn't remotely adhere to what they're claiming on the packages.
Yeah, definitely. And that goes to a broader problem that the FDA is trying to deal with in dietary supplements in general. And so it's coinciding with this push that they've already had to say, we don't have the capacity to regulate all of these products and make sure they actually have the things in them that they say they do, whether it's CBD or like a muscle supplement or something. And so they need more manpower too. But also in the meantime, it can go in the opposite direction of not having any CBD in it. Sometimes it has too much THC in it. So not to get too technical, but CBD products, or at least the legal form that Congress has legalized, have 0.3% or less THC. Sometimes there can be more, and then that can show up on someone's drug test.
And THC is from marijuana.
Yes, that's still the Schedule I federally illegal drug.
So bringing it back to Friday's hearing, Sarah, is this going to be essentially a parade of carnival barkers pushing their CBD products mixed with regulators, mixed with average patients? Is there a different sort of focus expected from who is going to be speaking?
Yeah, I don't know if they'd call themselves Carnival Barkers, but
that's what I'm choosing to call them.
They'll be manufacturers, representatives of agriculture, public safety, a coalition of state representatives that are going to talk about what has already been done on the state level that they don't really feel the federal government needs to step into, patients, doctors. One really big focus for the FDA that Deputy Commissioner Amy Abernathy has already tweeted about has been this idea of people self-dosing, and if they, you know, take a CBD pill, then put it in their drink, then put an ointment on, and, you know, these long-term effects of if you do that, which, you know, some manufacturers have been frustrated about that, saying, you know, you can take too much calcium, but it's not the fault of the calcium. But the problem is we know what happens when you take too much calcium. We don't know what happens when you take too much CBD.
This is still uncharted territory in some respects. This push for clarity around CBD comes at the same time as there's been push for legalizing marijuana, or at least legalizing medical marijuana. Paul, you've written on this extensively, and in April, you wrote that, quote, legalizing pot is the new Democratic litmus test in the presidential campaign. Really?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I mean, if you look at this sprawling field of 23 contenders, they are almost all calling for some form of full legalization. Exactly what that would look like might vary, but at the least, they're calling for states to be able to have fully legal markets if they want, without fear of federal punishment. The one big glaring exception to that is Joe Biden. And I believe he has only called for descheduling, or not descheduling, but rescheduling marijuana as a substance, Schedule 2, rather than Schedule 1, which is deemed the most dangerous drugs. And I think heroin and LSD are the other Schedule 1 drugs.
And the difference there, too, is that Schedule 1 doesn't recognize any medicinal value of a product. And so, as I've just mentioned, there's already been an FDA-approved drug that has a part of marijuana in it, Epidiolex. So people that get behind rescheduling, they're getting behind the fact that there is at least probably some sort of research element that needs to happen.
And marijuana legalization advocates have argued to change the scheduling because of the criminal risk of Schedule I drugs versus others.
Yes, but also I think for decades people have made the case that the marijuana being classified as a Schedule I is based on, you know, fear-mongering and, you know, not science. So exactly what Sarah is speaking about, there is, you know, obviously some evidence of you know, medicinal properties. So to have it classified as Schedule I just seems like, you know, contrary to the facts at this point.
Let's bring it back to 2020. You mentioned that Joe Biden has not come out in the same way that other candidates have on legalizing marijuana. If this really is a litmus test, if Biden doesn't support legal pot, is his candidacy doomed?
Well, that's the thing. Okay, so I think, you know, the vast majority of Democrats, particularly Democratic primary voters, support full legalization. Polling data will show you that. But is this a test? Is this an issue of high salience to voters? No. This is way down the list, you know, healthcare, education, taxes, whatever the big ones are. You know, legalizing pot is not at the top of many people's, you know, priority list. There are very dedicated activists for which this is their number one issue, but that's not, you know, that's not a broad salience issue for
most
voters.
The pot lobby is not known for being as vicious and aggressive as some of the other lobbies.
No. So even though most voters, particularly Democratic primary voters, again, might think that Joe Biden is out of step on this issue, that's not going to doom his candidacy by any means.
10 states in the District of Columbia have full legalization. Another 23 states do allow for medical marijuana with permission from physicians. You've written, Paul, about the push for more legalization. That was expected this year. There has not been as much momentum as we expected coming off the 2018 midterms. Why have efforts stalled?
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning of the year, it looked like you could easily have a half dozen states embrace full legalization. And those are states that had full Democratic control of the legislatures and Democratic governors that supported it. So it seemed like, you know, a recipe for getting this done. What we've seen in state after state is it's proven much more difficult than it looked at the beginning. And that's because anytime you get into writing legislation and all the different special interest groups that are going to weigh in and the different different points of views of lawmakers, it gets very messy. And this is an issue particularly around some of the equity issues that are raised by, you know, criminal prosecutions and the war on drugs that can get very sticky. So we've seen that in New York back in March. The process kind of ran off the rails. They're still trying to revive that. In New Jersey, just a couple weeks ago, they announced that its legislation is dead this year. They're going to go to a 2020 referendum. You know, Illinois is sort of the big one that's still out there. I got an email from a source last night actually saying they could bring this up as soon as today.
Today being Wednesday.
Yeah, they've only got 4 days left in the session, so it's kind of now or never.
Yeah.
But it's just proven a lot messier. You have seen some movement on medical marijuana in places that you might not have expected, like Texas expanded. It's pretty narrow medical marijuana program. Alabama, the Senate backed medical marijuana. I think it looks dead in the House now. And New Jersey is in the process of trying to expand its medical marijuana program.
Yeah, just adding to that, I think one of the smaller fights that you're seeing is which conditions get approved for medical marijuana. Some states have highly restrictive conditions that can be used for. And you mentioned New York earlier and that effort that failed for broader legalization. But I think around that same time, something that did succeed was putting period pain on the list of conditions that you could use medical marijuana for. So it's a smaller fight, but it's an interesting one to watch too.
Yeah, I mean, Texas is another good example of that. It used to be just epilepsy, but they've added terminal cancer, multiple sclerosis, ALS, autism, and several other things as things that you could get a medicinal marijuana referral for.
I see the argument, especially in a world where we're trying to crack down on opioid use and opioid addiction, that marijuana can be a suitable alternative to OxyContin for folks who might have serious pain or other issues. At the same time, I've always wondered, how much is medical marijuana simply a path for people who want to smoke pot recreationally and go and find a prescription from their pharmacist? I am drawing on my own experience when I went out to Stanford University years ago, and my roommate was a strapping water polo player, and his whole team of water, they looked like Greek gods. I think one of their names is actually Thor, and yet—
Did they attribute that to medical marijuana?
No, but they were bragging that they could obtain medical marijuana with like very easily. These were not guys who were in pain. These were guys who just wanted to party, essentially. And I know that that's not everyone, but I can't get that image out of my head. So is that where we are on medical marijuana in some cases, where people are using loopholes to get access to it?
I think that both things are true. And you bring up pain. That's a really interesting one because I'm, of course, I think many reporters are wary of, you know, touting these claims that it could help with opioid addiction or be a substitute for opioid painkillers. I mean, I think that there are levels to each of those, and one of the interesting things about pain is it's a very psychological condition too. And so if you believe it's helping you to a degree, it is helping you. And so I think there's even been recognition within our National Academies of Science that could be the case. And I wrote a story recently about veterans that are trying to use medical marijuana, and they mostly cite chronic pain and PTSD as the conditions that they're using it for. They've talked about reducing their prescriptions from 11 drugs to you know, half or less, or extending the time between taking pills. And if they believe it's working for them, then in a way it is. But it does get at some interesting questions around, I think, a lot of people that are pro-medical marijuana are wary of this, too. They're worried that we're going to oversell these claims and that people are going to be using it for all these, you know, bogus things.
The other point I'd make is that it's not like it's really difficult to get marijuana for high school kids or college kids in states where it's illegal. Kids are using it. Young adults are using it at very high rates in states where it's entirely black market. I think you need to look at that reality and say, are we better off bringing this into the light and acknowledging it and having a regulated market that, you know, raises taxes and that we can try to take steps to address things like motor vehicle safety and use by minors in ways rather than just pretend this isn't happening.
Right. We could get more definitive answers if we wanted to, but it's so federally restricted right now, it's pretty difficult.
And thinking about who might be benefiting but getting caught in that thicket of legal restrictions. Sarah, you had this story came out around Memorial Day about veterans who want to use the pot that they've been prescribed legally in their state, but are worried that it's going to cost them their military benefits.
Oh, yeah. And I had one veteran who actually even said to me, going back to this idea of the risk that they had, he was on opioid medications and eventually switched to heroin at one point. And he said that he injected heroin before he ever tried marijuana. And I asked him how that happened. And he said, because heroin gets out of your system in a few days and marijuana stays in for 3 months. And so if I go to my doctor and he drug tests, which doctors do in the VA, every time you go in for a general appointment, he would be labeled an addict, is what he said. There's a lot of fear around that. But going back to something Paul said earlier about this not really being the signature issue for voters, it also isn't necessarily the top issue for anyone in Congress, even the sponsors of bills that would help veterans, you know, not get these repercussions or actually be able to be prescribed these things. These bills have been floating around Congress for a while now. The markup for them was supposed to be last month. It was delayed. It's not clear when it's going to happen again. And going back to exactly what Paul said, there's wide consensus that people want this, but not a lot of momentum to actually push this forward and say this is going to be one of the top issues that Congress is going to do this year.
And the VA has been opposed to those bills, and I think that makes, you know, members of the Veterans Affairs Committee pretty squeamish. They want the VA on board, so that's maybe giving people pause.
Well, let's leave it there. Sarah, we'll look for your coverage from Friday's FDA hearing, and Paul, we'll follow your coverage of state legalization efforts. Thanks for joining Pulse Check.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
I'm joined now by two Pulse Check stalwarts. First, Adam Kankren, our Do It All Health reporter. Welcome back to Pulse Check.
Hey, Dan. Good to be here.
And Rachna Pradhan, our States reporter. Welcome back, Rach.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Wanted to get the three of us together because the presidential campaign is starting to heat up. Healthcare is playing a role. The Democrats are campaigning on it. The Trump administration is making moves to solidify its healthcare agenda. And there are a few issues that the three of us have been covering that I think are shaping up as potential defining issues in this campaign: abortion, drug pricing, some of the cultural issues around LGBTQ civil rights. So let's take those in order. And Rach, you've been writing about abortion access and specifically what it means for states like Missouri or Alabama to either push laws or see clinics close as local legislators have pushed a crackdown on abortion access. What is the state of abortion access in America circa 2019?
So I think the brief answer to that obviously depends on where you live. So if you live in a really rural part of America, if you live in the Midwest or the South, your access to an abortion is probably going to be much more limited than, say, in the Northeast or on the West Coast, where lawmakers tend to not be imposing as many restrictions for getting the procedure, either through limits on providers or also just gestational limits, right? Saying you can only obtain an abortion after X week of pregnancy under these circumstances. So I do think, you know, the recent wave of bans that have been passing, they're not necessarily going to limit access to abortion immediately. There have already been lawsuits filed and courts will block them. So really, laws like the ones in Alabama, Georgia, et cetera, we know they're not going to take effect. Those are designed to provoke challenges to Roe v. Wade. There are lots of other restrictions over time that have gone through state legislatures that do curb access much more significantly. We're going to have a piece shortly out on that, just looking at the overall landscape of these sort of slower drip-by-drip, you know, efforts that have percolated over the years.
And you talk about the essentially two Americas when it comes to abortion access. Making it even harder is if you're a poor woman in the South, in parts of the Midwest, the cost of traveling to another state or somewhere farther away to get access to abortion, that's significantly higher than, say, living in the New York City area or the Philadelphia area where there are clinics all around. Looking at 2020, and how Democrats are campaigning on abortion versus what the Trump administration is doing on abortion. Is there a lot left to decide, or has the administration already done about as much as it can do around things like Title 10 and other programs?
I think that now I don't I can't speak directly to things that they may or may not have underway at HHS about, you know, trying to curb access to the procedure. I am sure that a year and a half between now and the election is a long time to relook at regs, programs dealing with teen, pregnancy prevention. Maybe looking at, I mean, we know that the W. Bush administration looked at abstinence-only education. I mean, there's a lot of room for, I think, them to redouble efforts. And we know that there's a lot of backing, of course, in the administration to do those kinds of things. I will say that I think for now in 2019 at the state level, you know, a lot of the national reaction on abortion lately has been provoked by state laws one way or another, right? You had New York, which broadened access to abortion recently, attempting to codify protections that are available under Roe v. Wade in anticipation that the Supreme Court might do something. That provoked a huge backlash on the right. And now, again, you have the law in Alabama, which is leading to a lot of consternation from Democrats nationally. And so,
and also the Virginia battle with right. Governor Ralph Northam, which then led to the controversy over his blackface yearbook that was prompted by groups that were angry at Northam and Democrats in Virginia for trying to expand access to abortion.
Right, which now seems like an eternity ago, even though it wasn't.
Yes, he's still in office. He survived
that
somehow.
I know. He somehow survived it. But so what I was trying to say was, you know, state laws, state sessions are wrapping up in the next few weeks by and large. And so I don't think you're going to see, you know, more state bans or restrictions kind of passing at this point. Not really. And so maybe if you do see a sustained effort on attention to the anti-abortion or abortion issue, it might be because you'll see something at the federal level and not necessarily being provoked by state legislation.
And you'll see Democrats campaigning on it pretty aggressively leading up to the election. One issue that Democrats were expected to really push on this year, Adam, was drug pricing. There were Democrats who were elected in 2018 who said this is a pocketbook issue for our constituents. Representative Lisa Blunt Rochester was on this podcast recently, yeah. The Delaware congresswoman, who talked about the need to do health reform that would benefit her state. But we haven't seen drug pricing reform come out of Congress yet. How real is this effort as we come up on the halfway mark of the year?
Well, it's certainly real. And I think Democrats especially, but Democrats and Republicans both realize that the high cost of prescription drugs, lowering those prices, is something that is supported, you know, on a bipartisan basis. It's broadly popular among voters. This idea of, you know, somehow voters being able to go to the pharmacy and pay much less for their insulin or for their kind of chronic care drugs. The difficulty is, again, figuring out what policy will actually lead to that, to achieving that goal. And that's kind of the difficulty that both parties have had over the first 5 or 6 months here, is figuring out a couple things. You know, one, for Democrats in the House, what will work for them? And then also, is it possible that what will work for them can also kind of lead to a deal with the Trump administration? And that's kind of where we are now. There have been some, you know, kind of small ball reforms that have gotten through the House that will most likely by the end of the year pass through the Senate and be signed by the administration. That's great, but that's extremely low hanging fruit. I think what the big goal is a broad drug pricing package that includes some provision that empowers the government to negotiate with drug makers. The difficulty is figuring out how much power you give the government, and then what effectively is the stick? What's the enforcement for if the private sector doesn't cooperate? And that's where we're at now. My colleague Sarah Carlin Smith and I reported last week that there's a plan kind of being circulated among Democratic leadership that would allow for negotiation, but on a limited from a limited standpoint, and it would basically kick a final decision for a price to a federal agency, to the GAO, rather than allowing Medicare or the federal government just to set a price and say live with it. The thought process is that, look, this is something that maybe Republicans will be able to get on board with, but at this point, now you risk losing progressives on the far left, you risk losing conservatives on the far right, and becoming increasingly difficult to triangulate a deal there.
You mentioned measures that could move through not just the House, but the Senate, and then get signed into law by the president. President Donald Trump referenced a few weeks ago that he would not
sign measures. You would not get on board with Democrats unless they dropped investigations of his administration. Was that a hollow threat?
Well, in short, nobody on the Hill is really taking him seriously on that. The thought being that the one thing that the president has remained consistent on is his desire to lower prescription drug prices. That's something, if you go back to the campaign, if you go back to the early days of his presidency, Trump has said, and he's told his administration and members in Congress, this is the one thing that we need to get done. And so the overriding belief is that that desire for a big win on prescription drugs is going to outweigh any kind of frustrations with Democrats on, you know, on impeachment, on investigations, on things like that.
Just thinking about the timing, we are now in the Memorial Day recess, so Congress is away. They will come back for the rest of the summer. When do they have to have a drug pricing package done this year for it to move through?
Well, this is the difficulty. We're in a pretty close time crunch now. The general belief is that anything that's going to get done without potentially getting gummed up with 2020 politics has to be done by August recess. You might have a little bit more of a window when everybody comes back in September, but that's really close.
Because by the end of the year, candidates will be focused on the trail.
Exactly. By the end of the year, people are starting to look toward 2020. There's more maneuvering with a kind of more political mindset. There's maybe less incentive from both Democrats and Republicans to do a bipartisan deal and potentially give the other side, you know, something that they can run on.
So this summer is the window.
So this summer is essentially the window. And it's a big agenda. I mean, in addition to drug pricing, you have to do something on surprise billing legislation, which is the only other real bipartisan possibility out there. Democrats still want to do a lot of things to shore up and improve the Affordable Care Act. So you're talking 3 months to do some huge priorities with a drug pricing plan that isn't even out yet. And if you remember back at the beginning of this Congress, leadership had originally signaled that they were going to have a plan out by February. It is now almost June, and we're still only seeing kind of tentative outlines. So it's going to be a sprint to get something done that's this big and this potentially dramatic.
And fun fact, I think by the time listeners hear this, I will have this in pulse. But May 30th, I believe, is the anniversary of President Trump declaring that drug companies would come out with massive voluntary price cuts in lowering their prices. I'm not sure we ever saw that take place on the level that he teased. Well, we will look to see what happens with drug pricing.
So, Dan, you have been writing about some of the administration's recent moves on LGBTQ issues and conscience regs. Why don't you walk us through, do you think there's a political upside going into 2020, and who has the greater advantage?
It's a really interesting question. So the Trump administration has been busy the past couple weeks on issues related to religious liberty, conscience rights, and healthcare, and somewhat beyond, too. But HHS in May alone finalized its conscience rule. This is the rule that would allow health workers, physicians, nurses, but also janitors and other healthcare workers to decline to participate in procedures if they had a religious or moral objection. Some of these regulations already existed. The Trump administration is just putting more strength behind those rules and expanding it more broadly. More recently, in this past week, and Rach, you joined me on this story, the Trump administration rolled back a anti-discrimination rule that had been part of the Affordable Care Act. It's gotten a lot of attention because that rule banned discrimination in healthcare for transgender patients, but there were implications for all LGBTQ individuals as well. And you ask about the implications for political upside. Some of the Trump administration's most fervent supporters are Christian conservatives. Some of his most loyal fans have been folks that you never would have put behind Donald Trump 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And yet, this administration has rolled back abortion access and done other things like these conscience rights rules that have really won the president support. There are more things that group of voters still wants to see happen. But the Trump administration has already given them quite a bit. On the flip side, there are Democrats who are trying to lean on this issue. And in the hours after HHS last week announced it was rolling back these discrimination rules, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, Pete Buttigieg, and other Democratic candidates immediately jumped on this. So it's a very potent issue on both sides. It's unclear as of now who has the edge in terms of turning out voters.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you know, a couple questions come to mind. But, you know, the one chief one for me is, you know, is this a defensive move on the Trump administration's you know, side, or is this an offensive move? And by that, I mean, who else is asking for these rules beyond the base that was going to be with Trump no matter what? Is this more about making sure, you know, turnout is there in 2020 and the sliver of people who are really passionate about this? Or is there any kind of broader appeal here?
It's interesting. I think the Trump administration knows where its bread is buttered. And Rach, you did a great story with our colleague Alice on Mike Pence and how his influence is felt throughout the administration. Some of these rules harken back to policies that Mike Pence, a Christian conservative, advanced in Indiana. And some of the staff throughout the administration are believers in these policies as well. So this is paying back, to some extent, the folks who helped get the Trump administration into office. We don't have a great sense for how many people actually want these changes, though. I wrote a story a few weeks ago with Andrew Rustuccia on our White House team about how HHS was justifying its conscience rule and pointing to data that many physicians wanted this rule to be changed. That data was cherry-picked data by Kellyanne Conway 10 years ago, back when she was a private pollster working with the Christian Medical Association, which surveyed its own members. So there isn't a broad base of folks, as far as we can tell, in kind of nationally recognized surveys who've been clamoring for this. It is a very passionate group of supporters of the Trump administration and other conservative politicians.
I think we have to remember one thing about that, though, too, is, you know, as far as who's asking for it, you know, the non-discrimination regs, as you noted, were a part of the ACA. There are lots of parts of the ACA that Republicans really don't like, and we tend to focus the most on sort of the coverage expansion pieces of it, right? But this is also, I think, something that in Republicans' views or conservatives' views, that also went a step too far. And if you see a lot of their healthcare agenda, obviously, is about not only pursuing sort of these bipartisan efforts, maybe surprise billing, drug pricing, but also about rolling back a lot of what happened under the Obama years, whether it's Medicaid, private insurance related. And then there's this non-discrimination piece also. I think there were parts of the ACA that dealt with religious issues, contraception, conscience protections, et cetera. And this is just another way of undoing that.
That's right. And this rule, this transgender protection rule, got a lot of flack because some conservatives said it was requiring doctors to perform gender transition procedures or assist in them against their will. And that's been a line of attack about why it needed to be rolled back. I've talked to many advocates and legal folks who say that's not the case. Katie Keith, a Georgetown law professor, has made this point to me a few times, that there was nothing in the regulation that required a doctor to wield a scalpel. It was more about just protecting patients, not compelling workers to go against their religious beliefs if they didn't want to do a gender transition procedure. There was nothing forcing them to do that.
So I mean, impact-wise, is this more about the messaging, or is this an actual on-ground effect?
I think it's both. I think this is a policy position. Everything that the Trump administration has done to deliver for Christian conservatives is something that will be trumpeted when President Trump is in front of those crowds. I also think it's something that Susan B. Anthony lists on the abortion access questions and religious rights moves that HHS has made. Susan B. Anthony list, the anti-abortion group that's really good at a ground game, will be able to send its volunteers, its organizers out and say, look what this administration has done. And if you want to see more of this, you got to keep this guy in office. Why don't we leave it there? And we'll have you guys back as the campaign continues to develop. Rach, Adam, thanks for joining.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to colleagues Adam Kankren, Sarah Overmall, Rachna Pradhan, and Paul Demko for sitting down to discuss their reporting, and Mikhail Rodriguez for producing the show. If you like Pulse Check, you can help us. All you have to do, go to iTunes, go to your favorite podcast app, leave a rating or review that helps new listeners discover the show. If you have suggestions, you can find me. I'm ddiamond@politico.com by email. And you can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week.